Hello, and you're very welcome to this episode of the Life Well Lived podcast. This is the show that is crystal clear on the fact that no matter who you are and where you are in life, challenges are absolutely inevitable, and the best thing all of us can do is to equip ourselves with the tools to navigate those challenges and to live our own life well lived. My name is Shane Breslin, and my mission in my life's work through my writing, coaching, speaking, and with this very podcast is to provide the support, guidance, and inspiration you need to help you through those challenges so that you can know and fully embrace the unparalleled wonder of your own uniqueness, to get clear on what truly matters to you, and to discover a life of vitality, fulfillment, and happiness. This is episode 19 of the podcast, and my guest is someone I've been paying attention to online for about a year and a half now, and when the opportunity came up to have him on the show, I couldn't wait to do it. He's an exceptionally talented writer with his own iconic style, both in his always-on short form on Twitter and through his longer and even more thoughtful posts on his website and email newsletters, which cover topics such as how to know if you've got a drinking problem, strategies to deal with imposter syndrome, and how to forgive a fucked up world. Ed Lattimore is a military man, a pro boxer, a physics major, and a high-class chess player. Mostly, though, I think he's a modern philosopher. So we talked about his philosophy for life and living in the 21st century. We chatted about his childhood growing up in the projects of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in the US, and what he describes as the disease of poverty. We talk about sobriety. Ed is approaching 6 years sober and credits this decision perhaps more than any other with putting him on a path to salvation. We talked about what it is to be a man that people can respect, and we discussed the phenomenon of toxic masculinity. We talked about Twitter and the role that particular social network has played in his rise. And we also chatted about the one action people who are stuck can take this week to start moving the dial on any issue. This is one of my favorite interviews for this podcast, and I hope that you enjoy it too. So without further ado, here it is, my Life Well Lived podcast interview with boxer, writer, social media influencer, and modern philosopher, Ed Lattimore. Ed Lattimore, it's so good to have you on the show. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thank you for having me, man.
I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about your philosophy. I've seen you, you're all over my Twitter, let's put it that way, for the last year or more, and I've seen that develop and grow quickly for you. And you have, I think it's fair to say you have a clear philosophy in multiple different directions. Two-part question. What is your philosophy, or could you describe your philosophy about life and how we live it? And has that always been the case, or how has that developed over the years?
So the first part, my philosophy, I would say that my philosophy is that progress is everything. There's no real destination. The whole goal of everything we do and all the good feelings we enjoy and experience and seek in life is all the result of conquering, overcoming, moving past your weaknesses, moving past obstacles in nature and obstacles in your life. I really believe that there's no such thing as a location of happiness. Rather, it's a rate of change. So that's the first part of my philosophy. In terms of has it always been this way? You know, it's funny. I was talking to my girlfriend yesterday about something, and I was thinking about how when I was younger, my idea of what a good life was like just kind of making it to this point where I didn't have to worry about not eating, right? Because I grew up really poor. And so I just wanted to get to this point where I could worry about like not eating and relax. And I would do whatever it took just to get to this point, which really, you know, as I know now, is not that far from being poor. It's just one step up. So I didn't always have this philosophy. I always was really just kind of seeking a way out of where I was. And to me, that was a minimum amount of energy. And now I know that I'm really more satisfied when I continue to move, continue to grow, and continue to conquer and just get better.
Interesting. And it's something that I heard Marianne Williamson, actually. She's in the running for the Democratic nomination in the U.S. And she probably has very, very little chance of getting a nomination, never mind being president. But she has some interesting things to say. And I look at this from afar because I'm the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. But she was talking about the volume of people in the US, and I think this was reflected outside the US too. This is not just in the US, but the volume of people who are in great fear of the next payday. Like, they're living effectively, you know, day to day, week to week, month to month, and they've this incredible, I think she called it financial anxiety, or just afflicted with this financial anxiety. It sounds like you've had that from your first answer. You've experienced that, and you've kind of talked about a little bit of kind of how close actually that, how within reach that feeling of not being there is for so many people. Does that resonate with you at all? Do you see lots of people that are just afflicted by this kind of financial anxiety, or this feeling of just of not being able to kind of to make any ground effectively?
Oh, for sure. You know, and I used to be the exact same way. Like, I know that feeling very well, of wondering, you know, and it manifests in different ways, but it's everything from going to the supermarket or getting gas or wanting to do something and worrying if your card's going to be declined, to like hoping that your check engine light just goes off and you can continue to get back and forth to work and everything without having to expend money, or hoping that like you don't get sick. I mean, the things that, like, when you have a little bit of extra that are just minor annoyances at worst can be truly devastating when you're in that position of, like, you know, just paycheck to paycheck, or even worse. I mean, and now I think this is a personal habit, or even worse, you know, where you're constantly behind and you don't even realize it. And that feeling that's uncomfortable. And the way an uncomfortable is probably like doing it a really, is putting it really nicely. And when I remember, you know, I got really tired of that feeling, and I started taking steps to not have that feeling anymore, which ironically involves making yourself voluntarily uncomfortable as opposed to involuntarily uncomfortable. You know, a lot of people spend their entire life avoiding voluntary discomfort, so they have to suffer involuntary discomfort. And once it clicked, like, it really clicked for me that I was gonna have to do some hard things over a period of time that may seem long, but in retrospect, it was short, very short. Then my life started to improve.
So let's take a step back, or let's rewind a little bit to give people a sense of who Ed Latimer is, or where you've come from. Tell me, where did you grow up, and what was your upbringing like?
So I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, here in the United States, and I grew up on a public housing project. And I grew up in two of them. One called, you know, it was called Terrace Village, and then they went to tear that down. And then when they tore that down, they moved us to another one called Northview Heights. And public housing projects, I know in the UK, they're called council estates, I believe.
Same in Ireland, yeah. Same thing in Ireland, yeah.
All right, and so that idea, you know, except in the US, there's a much bigger gun violence issue, and that really exacerbates things and gives cowards power and everything. So you know, I grew up in this environment, and that people don't realize poverty is like a disease. It really is. And I say it's a disease because what it does is it infects you, and obviously there's the immediate acute symptom. You can't buy what you want to buy. And really you can't buy what you need to buy, but then there are the chronic things that you're afflicted with. You know, everything from, like, scarcity mindset is real. You almost lose the ability to think long term, and I really have to be cognizant of this when I talk to people. You lose the ability to think long term because everything is a short term crisis. And because you're always reacting to short-term crises, you never learn to think, okay, let me be a long-term kind of guy. Let me just kind of buckle down and get this done, and I'll be able to get out of this environment. You know, you end up surrounded by people who, you know, the funniest thing, it's so hilarious to me as an adult now, thinking about one of the biggest insults kids used to sling around in my neighborhood was, you bought that at the Goodwill. And I'm like as an adult, I'm like, yeah, we should be buying stuff at the Goodwill. We don't have any money. But everyone wants to appear like they have something, and they want to laud that over other poor people. So you deal with a lot of these issues. And, you know, it's funny. I'm writing a book right now about you know, kind of how my upbringing brought me to where I am. But really, in a general sense, you know, a lot of the lessons I learned. So some of this stuff is fresh in my head, but some of it I never even, you know, I haven't thought about until now. And particularly, like, the disease that poverty is, and just what you have to do. It takes so much work to overcome, and not just the financial habits, but the emotional way you look or your emotional relationship with money, and your sense of self, and how you go about establishing your sense of self with other people. One big thing poor people love to do is they feel valuable when they have valuable things and they can show them off. We see this a lot in the rapper culture, that is a direct, like it was born in the ghettos, in the hoods, in the projects, the council states. And we see that, the whole being flashy, the bling, you know, that is a direct result of us not understanding how to gather self-worth. Because it's really hard to build self-worth in a place where everybody's in a position where there's no money, you know? And that's what you become, that's what you come to buy, you know? What you lack is what becomes your God in many ways.
Did you, I'm assuming, and let me make the assumption, you can tell me if the assumption is wrong, that very many of the people that you would have grown up with, been friends with, been neighbors with, might have struggled to leave that environment behind.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I tell people all the time, I mean, or maybe I don't actually, but I don't have any. I mean, there's like two people I kind of keep like that I could keep contact with, but I don't really talk to anybody from my neighborhood with growing up. Now, what's really interesting is that, you know, we have social media now, and so you can see where everyone is, and social media is not like a luxury. Literally everyone has it. And there's some guys, man, I'm really proud of them. You know, one way or the other, they went and got out, and, you know, when we come back and we talk and see each other, I just linked up with a guy who he was just in Turkey, and I'm like, man, that's crazy. Like, you know, you travel and you go do these things, and we grew up, and it wasn't even like forget. I didn't even understand what a passport was till I was like in college. Forget high school, you know, where you get them, and to go and see guys traveling. No, I travel myself. You know, I look at that and I go, you know, it's definitely possible. But that's because most things in life are probabilistic rather than deterministic. And you greatly increase the probability of failure growing up in that life, but it doesn't make it a guarantee. I would like to think I'm a great example of the outcome not being guaranteed. It's just the probability.
Yeah. No, I totally understand. So reflecting on that period in your life and how you left it behind, I guess, and leaving the neighbor behind and getting out in the world and building yourself for it. What was that, something that you feel was built or came from within, or were there a number of people, whether in your neighborhood or outside the neighborhood, that became kind of role models for you?
So I think about this a lot. I think about this a lot. And what it comes down to is, you know, there are things I can't control, things I can control, things that were with innate, and things I had to learn. Let's, you know, tackle the easy part first. Internally, the traits, I was just one of those kids that was born with a great deal of, I think, grit and toughness. And I also, for whatever reason, came out with a much higher respect for authority than I think the average person even has, let alone kid in that environment. That really helps, you know, because you fear. Now, it might be because I have a really strong connection or strong understanding of cause and effect. So I realize, you know, if I do this, there will something will happen. I really don't want that to happen, so let's not do that, right? So that kind of helps. So, you know, I think that is an innate personality thing. I think my IQ, that certainly helped. I didn't have any control of that. And I say that helps not because it makes me like smarter than everyone and to figure things out, but you had to remember, part of the difficulty growing up in this environment is that you don't get exposed to anything else but that environment. I grew up in a city, in a time, in a place where they were actively filtering for kids who showed any signs of being, you know, what they called in my district, gifted. And once they recognized me, they put me to the test. I got to go to another school one day a week, and just and with other kids from around the city who were not from the same socioeconomic class as me. That does, I mean, I don't know how much, like if I was to like weight this out on a pie chart or something, but that's huge because I got to see from a very early age that there was something different than what I grew up around. That's huge, you know? And I got to see, you know, maybe there's a different way to live. There's different behaviors that I can take on, different people I want to be around and be like. Okay, so that, you know, that's what is innate. In terms of like people and environments and things that I could put myself around, when you have all that, it really, you know, you make choices that people may in your position may not have made, you know, in terms of, you know, I try to get involved in sports when I could. I tried to spend as much time as possible away from home when I got to high school, because one of the things that changed for me is I went to a high school across town. Not, you know, elementary school, middle school, I was like right in the thick. My elementary school was like in my housing project, which is crazy, right? But, you know, right in the thick and around that. But when I made a conscious decision, I'm like, whatever I got to do. And I was fortunate. We have a lottery system, and I, you know, I won the lottery the way it works out. Without going into too much detail, or one of the kids that won. So I got to go to a high school across town, and once again in a different bracket of people that I would have grown up with, and I spent as much time as possible in this neighborhood. You know, I didn't, I wanted nothing to do with it, with where I was from. That really helped. And then because I'm spending all that time around these people, I'm getting further exposed to different ways of living. I get people to look up to. I get people to see. Now, it doesn't immediately sink in. I certainly wish it had. But it diverts the track, you know. I was on one track and then I jump on another one, and it's like all diversions, you know. You at the beginning, the difference in their location is not so profound. Over time, as they keep going, you know, by change of 1 degree, it makes a much bigger difference over time. And I look at my life now at 34 compared to when I came into high school at 14. That's 20 years. I am light. I mean, like, I can't even. I'll never be like. There are some things you never say never about. I can legitimately say. I may never be like, you know, super rich, but I'll never be poor again, like never, ever again, you know. And a lot of that just takes time. I'll always have, I under, you know, and that's just one aspect of it. I had to learn, for example, and this took longer. I had to learn how to have a proper romantic relationship, because you don't have any role models around. You know, I grew up in effectively a single household. Like, I knew my dad, but my mom raised me. I saw my dad maybe 3 times a year, 3 or 4 times a year. Yeah, he didn't live with us, and he didn't really provide that much assistance beyond what was mandatory by the state. I mean, he sometimes helped, but not really. So I had to learn that, and I had to learn it a lot of times by seeing other people, and that makes a big difference. I had to learn how to be friends, you know. I all this stuff you got to kind of learn, and I think about all the people whose path I crossed, as I was learning and as I continue to, and we're always learning, but there's a time when you know a lot less, and as a result, you do a lot more damage. And I will never ever make an excuse for anything that I may or may not have done. But one thing has become crystal clear to me at 34, looking at a lot of my other family members and seeing how we were all raised in kind of the same environment, and also seeing people who aren't related to me and seeing how they have turned out. It is, while I will always say you're 100% responsible for where you go in life and what you do, it is completely foolish and ignorant to discount the role that your parents and your upbringing have. You know, I have cousins, I have aunts who literally, aunts and uncles who literally raised all felons. And that's not an accident. You know, I'm probably the only one, certainly my mom's side of the family now, who's never been to prison. So, we're all raised the same around the same people. I turn out differently. Why is that? Well, it's probability, but you increase the chances of ruining someone when you raise them in that environment.
Do you ever reflect on that? I think you said it was like the lottery system of that opened some windows or doors and showed you a different way. Do you ever reflect on how things might have turned out if that didn't happen?
Oh, all the time. Here's what I will say. I don't know how much that gifted program affected my life. I think now, looking back on it, it probably did more than even I give credit for. But one thing I say, one of the biggest decisions I ever made that really changed my life, because I am aware of it now, is, you know, they found me and scouted me when I was like 5 or 6, as opposed to when I go into high school at 14. I made the choice where to go to high school and being around the people I wanted to be around. And that was a conscious choice and decision. And I think about what my life would have been like if I had went to the school that my neighborhood fed into. I wouldn't even, you know, I wouldn't know the people I know now. I wouldn't have had their influence. I would not have developed and grown at all. I just, the opportunities, the things I was exposed to, the whole, and one thing I like to compare it to, I always say, you know, I'm sober, I'll be, you know, be sober in 6 years on December 23rd. I talk about all the things, all the situations I'm not part of or haven't been part of for the past 6 years. They could have ruined me in any number of ways. I don't know what they are, but I do know my life wasn't even close to what it was or what it is now when I was drinking, right? So now that I'm not drinking, there's a whole thing, whole set of nights where I'm not making decisions to drive home, whole set of times where I'm not talking to people I would have otherwise talked to or got involved in situations I would otherwise got involved in. And so I don't know what I'm missing, but I know it can't be better than where I'm at now. And that's kind of how I feel about my decision where I went to high school. I don't know what I missed, but I do know that what I got and where I went and who I was exposed to and the people I met, some of them I see now, and a lot of them actually I talk to now because they're, you know, people I went to high school with. I know that changed me for the better. And I got to take, eventually, I mean, it took some time and I'm still perfecting it. But right now, especially over the past 4 years, I think, I've really come into my own and, you know, taken distilling the good parts from my childhood and taking the lessons that the worst parts took, you know, gave me, and really use it to give me an advantage that I would not have had I been born even middle class or upper middle class. I certainly would not ever want my kids to go through remotely anything close to what I went through growing up. But there are lessons that can be that you can learn, and you can't learn any other way. Like I would be like, you can't make someone street smart. You know, I legitimately believe that. Like one of the gifts I think I have, or talents or skills, is the ability to read people. You know, and I also understand that a negotiation is about making both people feel like they leave with something better, even if I inside feel like I'm a little worse off. It's kind of the ability to gauge the overall climate and to make a smart decision that minimizes your damage, maximizes their gain, or at least the appearance of gain, so you can walk away and be happy and have an ally and not someone that's going to smash you with a brick in 3 days because they feel like you got over a little better on them. That kind of deal. So that education, you can gain, I'm sure, like, at the upper levels, like maybe in, like, some FBI building, you can be taught that. But some of these skills, you know, some of these perspectives and this appreciation for life, no one can give that to me. I got that the hard way. And as much as I would love for any of my offspring to take it and go get it, you know, I have to be more creative in the way I get those lessons to them because, you know, they're not going to get them the way I got them.
Yeah. And like choices and choice theory is something that I have reflected a lot on and thought about the impact of the choices I was making and the impact that they had on my life and my life and the lives of those around me, including my children. And I think it's that whole kind of cyclical framework of the choices we make that create opportunities. And we don't know what the opportunities might be, and the choices can be positive or negative. So the choices we make and the things that cause and effect, so the opportunity that's created from that choice, and later on there's a moment or a period of reflection if we choose to take that moment or period of reflection, which leads us then to another choice, this compounding effect that can grow from there. Suddenly amazing things can happen or terrible things can happen depending on the track we kind of set out on.
Right. It's really, really interesting and fascinating to me because aside from, like, you know, my growing up, I think I really stumbled a bit in my early 20s. And then I got my mind right. I said, you know, I got to stop drinking. I got to go back to school. I got to really put myself effort. I got into a really solid relationship that to this day is still great. That's with the woman I'm moving over to Portugal with. And I think about how I wasn't sure how it would turn out. In fact, when I started this path of improvement that's ultimately led me to where I am now, when I started this path, I was, you know, I wanted to be, you know, I envisioned myself having some kind of like job, maybe in finance, maybe in a lab, in grad school, whatever, who knows, right? But just because I didn't end up there doesn't mean it was a failure. I don't think anyone would call it that. But my initial goal above all things was to stop what I was doing because that wasn't working. And I could take – I always use the analogy, or I tell the story from The Matrix. In the first Matrix movie, when they pick up Neo and they're taking Neo to meet Morpheus and he's about to run out the car – because, you know, they're freaking him out and that bug's in his stomach that the agents put in. And so he's about to run out the car. And Trinity stops him and goes, you know, you don't want to go down that path. Neo, you already know where that path goes and where it ends and you don't want to be there. I'm paraphrasing, right? And I always think about that because I sat there and I remember being 27 and I was like, you know, I don't know where what I'm doing, or rather not doing, ends. I don't know that. I do know that if I don't do something now and dramatically turn this ship around, it's going to run into an iceberg eventually. I'm not, maybe I'll see it, maybe I won't, but I'm going to do something, or I'm going to put myself in a position to where recovery will be close to impossible. And on top of that, you know, there's like the law of inflation as it applies to human behavior. If, you know, at 27, I'm still a loser, but if I was doing the same stuff and living the same way with the same income, which was effectively $9.28 an hour, if I was doing that same stuff now at 34, oh, I'd be a ghost. I mean, my girl wouldn't be me. I wouldn't be able to train. No one would care what I say. I wouldn't have any way to make money. And then if I woke up, all right, time to get started. So in 7 years, I'm 41. But in 7 years, you know, even then, you know, certain avenues I took would be locked off, like enlisting in the military. That's one of the ways I really fixed things and got it together. So the earlier you correct course, the easier it is. I think, because then what messes with me, right, is I go, man, I think about where I'm at now. If I had got myself right at 25, right? But that's a useless way to think, I find.
Yeah, totally. And was that a decision that you make that you made, or was there a moment of clarity and epiphany that you had at 27 years old that just turned you in the right track?
Oh yeah. You know, everybody's moment. Not everyone. My moment of clarity was uncomfortable and painful. You know, I was working at a cell phone store, a retail store, and someone came in late and they were there and they had to stay and I couldn't kick them out and I didn't make any money off of this and I was only making $9.28 and I didn't have any future, I didn't have any skills to make money. I was more worried about going to the bar, drinking and that. I was like, let me get out of here so I can go to this party. And I was just like, what the hell am I doing? I mean, that's really what I felt like. And I had, that was my first moment. Then I enlisted, I finished, I'm enrolled in school and whatever, and I try to go out when I come back from my first, when I come back from all my basic training and stuff, and I go out and I go to drink and I act a fool and embarrass myself. And I go, what am I doing with this alcohol? You know, I clearly cannot behave correctly. Let me cut this, because the way this is going to influence me, I'm going to do something. I'm going to go over a cliff of no return where no apologies can't correct the thing. And you know, fortunately, I didn't have to make that decision from a prison cell, right? So, because a lot of guys do, they get sober after they've done something really bad. I got really close, but I didn't quite cross the bridge, you know. So I said, let me put this away. Let me not do this. Let me not be here. And it really, I think back on it, you know. I went and got a tattoo to celebrate my 5 years, and I 5 years sober, and I was like, I really changed the course and outcome. I don't know where it went. I don't know where we were going to end up, but those moments, going back to school, I opened up opportunities for me, and not drinking opened up opportunities for me. Being in the military opened up opportunities for me. The work I do, the writing I put out, as a reflection of all the things in my life I've experienced, that opened up doors for me. So I just continue to open up doors, and it's made such a difference. But it all started, but I always say this, right? Before you can fill a bucket with water, you got to patch up any holes in the bucket. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. Like I could have been working 110, and I was at one point, right? I mean, putting in all this work into my training. But if after my training, I'm like, all right, let's go to the bar. Let's throw down, right? Then my training is washed. I have to fill up, or I have to, you know, cover the holes in the bucket so I can fill it with water and really get something going.
And I know since that time, or since that that moment that you made that decision, and you've gone back to school, you studied physics, I believe. You've got really good at chess from some of the blogs that I've read. So physics, chess. I know, but you're a professional boxer. You won. I think you won your first 13 fights as a pro.
Yeah, first 13 fights, then lost, and then drew, and then I put myself into retirement. Well, I actually was, you know, working on a comeback, and then I got hurt again, and then I said, you know what, I'm doing a lot of stuff, and that stuff is paying well, and it's not hurting me at all, and really let that mentality go. But then, you know what, with boxing is funny, because people underestimate how long it takes to get good at this thing. And, you know, a lot of stuff kind of clicked, and I think I'll fight again. I think I'll fight one or two more times in my life. You know, just because I have this wonderful talent, this wonderful skill, and it's coming together, and it keeps me healthy and in shape. You know, aside from like the damage you take, right? But I'm gonna die anyway. That's what I've always said. I'm gonna die anyway, and I would rather go out with some cool stories and be an inspiration than know that, oh man, that I didn't, you know, pull the trigger. Because look, it'd be one thing if I was like, if I was physically shot. Like, I had a lot of miles and damage in my body. But I didn't start fighting until I was 22. And I have not absorbed a lot of damage. You know, you get hurt like everyone gets hurt in any sport. But I haven't like been seriously hurt. And on top of that, I can, like, mentally, I continue to understand how to fight even more. And physically, I think I'm a little better, about the same. You know, I get my testosterone levels checked. They're still about the same.
We often hear that we learn more from our losses than our victories. Was that, you've only lost once. Is that what did you learn from your defeat?
Well, I only lost as a pro once. As an amateur, I lost a bunch. But you know, I learned quite a lot about life, man. Like, I wrote an article about this because, you know, I remember I was pinning it on the plane, you know, sketching out the details and everything. But one of the things that I really absorbed from my loss is that how you treat people as you come up is going to be how they treat you when you're coming down. That's one. You know, if I was an a-hole, you know, it would have been open season on me, man, because it's social media, right? But for the most part, you know, outside of a few, like, trolls who, like, that's what they do. Like, not everyone was cool. I also realized that, like, you know, there are way bigger problems. You know, I remember once upon a time, a few years prior, Randy Couture came and talked to a bunch of us fighting in a gym in L.A., and he was like, if the worst thing that happens to you in your life is that you lose a fight, you're doing pretty good. And that's one of those things that sounds really good until you live it. And then you're like, wow, that's powerful. Because the next day, I remember this, the next day after I lost the fight, I come down to the hotel room, I'm getting breakfast, you know, with the other fighters. And don't you know that what happened? So on the news, there was they started showing a story about Aleppo, Syria. Then they cut to a story about, I guess, someone had got shot by a police officer in both Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I believe Charlotte, North Carolina. I know it was North Carolina. And then this was also the same weekend. I fought on a Friday. This happened Friday night, so I learned about it Saturday morning. It was also the same weekend. Some guy walked into a mall. I believe it was Seattle. Maybe it was Tacoma, somewhere in Washington State. Killed 5 people, one of which was a 16-year-old girl who had, like, just been cleared of cancer. So it really put things in perspective. Like, I just lost a fight. There are people whose lives are altered, you know, simply because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's it. And you have to kind of be, I'm really, it's weird, you know, that's horrible stuff, and I would eventually probably find that lesson anyway. But having that and seeing that directly as I'm in my own little world of hurt and bother, that really made a difference to me. And I really picked up, you know, it's just fighting, like it's just boxing, man. And then, like, most people don't really care.
Let's bring it right up to now and what you're doing, what you're working on. I think you're a really prolific writer. I think it's you write at a high level and you write a lot. I think it's that's how I describe it from what I've read of what you're putting out there. Is Twitter, social media, Twitter and other social media, a tool, or do you see it as something that's really integral to what you do?
Both, man. First of all, I could not be where I am without Twitter. Let's not underplay the role that a tool that allows you to share your ideas, and if other people resonate with them, then their preferred method of interaction is to also share them, right? And then if they like you, they follow you. That's huge. It's huge. People underestimate. You know, I think Twitter is magic, personally. I think it's one of the closest things to magic in the sense that we have, or rather in the comparison to the way it's portrayed in the fantasy world that we'll ever have. So that's really big for me. That's helped me grow my writing. That's helped me grow my fan base. It's made me, I make a living now on Twitter by far. Like if I lost Twitter, Well, and, you know, I've been building up, I guess, redundancies or backups just in case. And by that, I mean my mailing list and my other social media. I'm building up Instagram. And then once I get Instagram to like 10,000, 15,000, I'll work on my YouTube channel and then grow on that. But really, the space that I exist in, which is for lack of a better term, and I hate this term, right? But I guess I'm in the self-improvement space to some degree. That means that I have to be visible. People have to know who I am. I have to share my ideas. I have to help. I have to grow. I have to help and grow. And social media just makes it so easy, you know. Even the internet made it easy. Social media made it easier. It's, you know, you can really grow a website and a following. And, you know, my website ranks so high and so well for many things. And, you know, I just looked at our domain authority and our domain rank, or our page authority and domain authority. And I'm just like, you know, it's great. You know, it's like 40. I'm like, cool. All right. And that, you know, to people listening, if they don't know what that means, you know, it just means that people take my page seriously enough and the traffic reflects that. So I just, you know, I don't understand people who use social media like a toy. I mean, you have fun with it, obviously, but I recognize the value of it from the start.
So many people have such extreme views about social media, and not even just on social media, because there's this like, you know, the noisy 5% at each end of the spectrum, and the 90% in the middle that nobody hears. I'm totally with you. Like my whole livelihood has been based on the internet. I've worked in media and worked on digital marketing communications for organizations for 20 years. 1999 I started in this. So, and there's lots that I hate about it, but I totally appreciate the massive benefits, and weighing these two things about the ways it can drain me on the one side, but the ways it can help me on the other. What is your relationship with it? Like, you know, all good, vast majority good. Are there things about social media? Like, what would you change about it, if anything?
What would I change? Nothing about the way humans interact with it. I would probably, you know, come up with a way to make it more engaging. Right. But I just, you know, I think they're a little, the way they enforce some of their concepts around, you know, what can and cannot be said can be called into question, but I'm not the guy who is going to currently scream censorship, because, you know, I see a lot because of how big my account is, and I have not seen any account that did not explicitly, you know, break a rule. Now, whether that was, you know, worth suspending over is a different debate entirely, but the rules as they lay out, you know, they're kind of easy to follow. And if you just, you know, be cool and treat people with respect as you should anyway, you're not gonna have any problems. I got a temporary suspension one time. That's all I needed, right? And I got it because I lost sight of, and really, it's funny how I got it.
Yeah, tell us how you got it.
I think 3 years ago I spoke someplace and my speech was about fear, but they like decided, so the rival, the guy who put on a conference, decided to dig in, and they wanted to like highlight that I was a red pill guy, and I was like, okay, I didn't see the big deal, but these people like piled on and really attacked. And that's when I learned that the tech industry is, you know, very liberal, and anything that looks even remotely not liberal, they attack, including me. And, you know, it was just going back and forth, and it was all good. Like, I wasn't like cussing anybody out and calling people names, because I knew not to do that. I'm not stupid. But that weekend, Wonder Woman opened, and I wanted to go see Wonder Woman. I thought it was going to be a great film, and it was a great film. But I tagged two of the people who were harassing me, and I said, hey, I'm going to go see Wonder Woman in my pink pussy hat. Does that make me a good feminist? And I guess because I used that word pussy in there, they decided I had to go. and they gave me a 12-hour ban. I said, you know what? I'm not even going to play this game with people because it's not – one, it's not worth it for my sanity, and two, because I built what I built on Twitter and I recognize the power of it. Since I'm not in control of that power, I got to play by the rules of the people who are in control. And it's not like you can't say anything. People just – you know, they don't want you being disrespectful and dropping, like, slurs and shit. Like I mean, it really is, like – it's really easy, like, and you can actually say quite a bit as long as you don't tag or attack someone directly. You know, once you do that, you kind of open a can of worms, and you start playing in that field. You know, if you don't play in that field, it's pretty good. But some people feel the need; they think that's their right. I mean, whether they're right or not, the rules are, and you follow the rules or you don't.
You brought up earlier on that when you were growing up and leaving your neighborhood behind, you had to learn, you know, how romance worked and how to be romantic. And you mentioned there a little bit about you were classified as a red pill guy. What is your opinion? Would you classify yourself as a men's activist? Or what's your opinion on kind of where men are in the world right now?
I'm not a men's activist. I don't care about any issue enough to get behind it. And there are some that I have an opinion on. But even then, man, because ultimately I recognize when you sit and think about an issue, something happens, and that is that you realize that both sides have a valid point. And almost no one is completely right or wrong because they're opinions, not facts. And so if they're not gonna, you know, you can't influence a mass group of people, they got their own agendas and stuff. So I'm not an MR, a men's rights activist at all, because mainly because I just don't see the point. Do they have good points? Sure. Right, but the other side has good points, if you want to call it that, and you got to look at how we got to this and all that. So I don't even get caught up in that. What I do get caught up in is living the best life I can live and being the type of man that I respect. And as a result, that kinda has led me to behave in a way that other guys look up to, and they go and they see, all right, here's somebody we can look to, or here's somebody we can, you know, kind of emulate the behavior. As far as where men are in the world today, I mean, so sure, the average guy is probably having a harder time of it than he did 30 or 40 years ago in the romantic realm. But who's striving to be, you know, just an average guy? Now, what we need to worry about, you know, some things that haven't happened, maybe they will, maybe they won't. We need to worry when guys who traditionally do have options and do have a little bit more, you know, benefit from the halo effect or whatever, or the height advantage in terms of income and all that, when they start suffering, you know. But all around the board, what it seems like is once again, you know, it's like when they talk about the IQ differences between men and women, the average, you know, is the same. The variance is unbelievably different. Women in general cluster around the average. Men, there are idiots and geniuses. Same with wealth. Women tend to cluster, well, men and women about the same. Women cluster on the average. There are more guys that are homeless, but there are also more guys that are millionaires and billionaires. Right. What you have to do, I think, as a guy, ultimately, is take responsibility kind of for yourself. And this is one of the funny things I think about. It's like, okay, so they have valid points, but every time a guy says something, they, like, decide to go, that guy is bitter or that guy's a loser, whatever. Because one of the things that we as guys kind of don't ever get to do is complain. We just get to act and make a thing right, you know. I can't sit around and complain about women, you know, because who cares, right? And it doesn't change my position in life anyway. What I have to do is go make myself into an attractive guy and then meet a girl. That's what I get to do. And wherever I find her, right, is where I find her, or I adapt and play a different game. But what we don't get to complain, even if our complaints are valid, men don't get to complain, men don't get to bitch. And that's kind of how it's always been. You know, men have always been the guys who went to war. They've been the guys who left their families, women and children first. That doesn't make any sense. You need guys to procreate the world, you know, but that's just how it is, you know. It's a lot easier to make more kids than it is, you know, to wait for the kid to grow up. That doesn't make sense, but that's just the burden of a guy. And I think a lot of, at the end of the day, right, while there are multiple forces, I focus on what I can control. And I think all guys should do that. And we control is putting ourselves in a position. Because I guarantee you, man, look, I've been a loser, I've been not a loser, whatever, right? Life is a lot better when you take control and build yourself up and you just kind of accept things and then move forward with them. You do that and life is going to be real good.
You mentioned earlier that you kind of wanted to become a man, the type of man that you would respect. And how would you describe that?
You know, first off, you know, you got to be financially capable. I think that's really important, because in my mind, having enough money to not rely on other people allows you to be that's like to be a leader. Like, you can't be a leader if you rely on someone else. At least for your own well-being. Obviously, your team relies on you, and you to an extent rely on your team. But part of being a leader is being in a position of independence and strength, so they can look to you and guide you. You have to be healthy. You know, I can't direct people on what I believe is the best way to eat and live and maintain their physical vessel and mental, you know, and emotional as well. If I'm out of shape, if I'm a mess, if I'm always, you know, a sloppy, disheveled human. Likewise, right, talking about the pillars of human growth, we touch finances, or we touch money, health and wealth, relationships, you know, whatever relationship you want to lead, you know, you have to be a leader in that, which with no man, what I think is an unacceptable position for a man is to be repulsive to the opposite sex. I'm not saying you got to be out there chasing. I don't, you know, whether you want to be a player, whether you want to get into a relationship, whether you want to be voluntarily celibate, but the moment you don't have options, the gene pool nature is sending you a very real message. You're not fit to reproduce. We don't want your genes in the gene pool. And that is no man that is worthy of respect. So that's where I would put it. You know, you got to be healthy. You got to be strong. You got to be accomplished. You got to take care of your business in that regard. And you have to have the option. You don't necessarily have to exercise it. However a man chooses to act, and however you choose to exercise it is your prerogative. You know, I happen to lean heavily on a relationship. I like my girlfriend. I like the person she is and being around her. I really don't, I'm not really drawn to the idea of, as they say, spinning plates or whatever. It's just not, you know, my thing. But if a guy is, that's cool too. I mean, there's pros and cons to every situation. But the meta idea is that you need to be capable of reproduction and have that option if you wanted it. And then, you know, we move to the next level. I think a guy's got to have a code of I just took care of the base, like my Maslow's hierarchy. The next level, you know, guys got to have some code of value, ethic, and honor. You know, you honor your word. People should be able to trust you in what you say. If they can't trust you in what you say, you got some growing to do. That's really important. And then however a man finds his place in the universe, whether that's through religion or introspection or service, I really think one of the criteria for being a useful, functional man or being good at being a man is that you have to build and contribute something to this world. But you know, is that like a base biological kind of determinant? No, that's something I believe in wholeheartedly, because I would not be where I am now if people didn't help me along the way. And so I think part of one, you know, a condition of attaining the independence to be a leader, I got to be able to give back and do the same to other people.
And the whole topic of what's called toxic masculinity, and which has like it's almost you can't say the word. Well, this I feel looking in from afar, sort of. I'm a man. I feel it's relevant to me, but I don't really get involved in the discussions for whatever reason. But it feels to me that every time you use the word, I'm not talking about you. Every time the word masculinity is used, it's almost prefixed by the word toxic. So these two words have gone together. Is there elements of masculinity that are toxic? What are your thoughts?
Sure, you know, there's elements of everything that's toxic. There are elements that are positive. The issue with the toxic masculinity, for me anyhow, is that we have, there's two issues. One, there's no female counterpart. You're not allowed to speak on that. You know, where's toxic femininity? We don't get to say that. We don't get to speak on that. But that's cool, right? Because part of being a man is you just deal with the burden. You know, we don't like to go. We don't complain. But guys in a know. You know, who know and are kind of, you know, they understand the signs and symptoms of toxic femininity and how to avoid it. So there's that. And then the other thing is that it just all gets grouped in, you know, it's just with masculinity. And that is probably a bigger, you know, if I was going to die on any sword, and this is not one I would, but if I was going to, that would probably be my biggest gripe is that, we've decided that all masculinity is toxic masculinity, when in reality, they're just toxic individuals who happen to be male, you know, which is why, you know, which leads to why there's no toxic femininity. It's almost like we are ignoring that and focusing on the male part for whatever reason. But you know, that's how they're going to be. I wish there was something we could do about it, but ultimately, my opinion on the matter is that when we discuss toxic masculinity and we don't make a distinction and we just say all masculinity is toxic, which a lot of people say and do, they don't recognize the role that femininity plays and the toxic femininity. Because, you know, you got to remember something, man. Guys are like unbelievably basic. If you tell us building a house is how you get laid, every dude you meet is going to be a journeyman carpenter or carpenter. That's just what's going to happen. So if we got a bunch of toxic masculine dudes running around, the question needs to be asked, who is rewarding this behavior? Why is this behavior stick? Because I guarantee you, if all of a sudden women were like, we're not going to sleep with any guy that displays XYZ criteria and stuck with it, then all of a sudden the market would have to respond. Economics is great at demonstrating this with the idea of a cartel, right? Or price fixing. They all fix the price, for example, at like seven dates with chivalry. Guess what happened? You know, if they all fix the price at guys without a criminal record who have a stable job, guess what would happen? But that's not what happened. You know, they want that, but the reality is, you know, guys who are truly toxic, drug dealers and thugs, are treated the same or are given a certain level of reverence with females that they guys who do the right thing can't quite understand. But that's the point. You know, you got to kind of understand that and go, there it is, and that's what we do.
Yeah, no, there's it's like everything. I think you said it at the start of when we started to speak that there is subtlety and nuance in everything, and any opinion or any determination that comes down 100% either way is probably almost certain to be wrong. So it is a very interesting discussion, and it's something I pay attention to. I've seen what my view, such as it is that I've seen really dreadful male behavior, but I think it's often doesn't come from a position of malice. I think it comes often from an inability to understand and articulate the emotions and desires that are going on inside, and then it comes out. It comes out with gambling or alcohol or drug abuse or whatever, violence. It comes out in all these ways. And I think that all of those are often a manifestation of the inability to really kind of be what is inside, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to be respectful of your time, and I'm very appreciative of all this, Ed. If we look at kind of the right now, the problem you're solving, and kind of the near future or where you're going, what would you say is the main problem you solve or help people solve when they come to read your work on Twitter and other places?
I want people to realize that no matter how bad it is, it can be better, but it becomes better only by the work you do. That's really it. You know, there's no way around it. You have to be willing to suffer, to voluntarily suffer, otherwise you're going to involuntarily suffer. And that's what it comes down to. And I think that's really the message and the idea that I resonate most around. That if you put yourself in a hard position and learn and work through it, then you can be in a better position. All improvement in life is like this. You know, someone has to work for something, and when they get it, then life becomes easier. Until then, you know, the saddest thing that I can ever see is someone who just tries to avoid hard work so they can enjoy life, and all of a sudden they turn 30 and it's like, oh wow, it's like I wish I had done X, Y, or Z, because now the people who have done things, they've moved on. I don't really like the people who I'm stuck with. On top of that, I have no freedom. Right? Like, freedom, that's huge, you know. Once you touch freedom, man, you can't really once you know what it's like to be able to eat when you want, where you want, you kind of can't go back to not doing that, you know? But that makes a big difference. You can just have some food and be good, you know? But those are little things.
Yeah. And the beauty of it is, I guess, is that, yeah, it's great to start as early as you can, but no matter where you are, you can start, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I like that. It's great to start as early as you can, but no matter where you are, you can start.
Yeah. So the people, apart from yourself, Ed, who out there, there's so much noise when we look at the world. Do you look at people that are worth following, paying attention to? How do you distinguish kind of truth from bullshit?
You know, I got a really good eye where I can tell when a guy hasn't had enough experience in life yet. I don't know if he's intentionally bullshitting me, but I can generally tell when a guy's under 20, under 25, and under 30. Because, you know, and I'm only 34, so I don't have anything else much higher. But it's really interesting how different some of the mindsets are, and just what they think in terms of everything from women to people to finance to fitness. And you just see these and you're like, oh, okay. You know, that's really the biggest difference. Other than that, I don't know if anyone's BSing me, right? Or at least not through the internet, unless they start speaking on something that I have intimate experience and knowledge with. And I'm like, that's a really odd thing to say, okay, right? That they would say. But, you know, part of sorting through the noise is I don't listen to much. So I have to sort through the noise in the first place. I try to stay focused on what I'm trying to do and what I'm trying to put out there. And that does not really require entertaining a lot of noise. Because, look, man, life is enough noise. If you're busy getting after things, I'm already busy. I already got enough on my plate. I don't need to sit and scroll through. I'm probably following 300 more or so people than I need to. But, like, I don't just sit there and browse Twitter, though. Like, I don't use the platform like that. Because I'm the one trying to give people something.
Last couple of questions, if I may. If somebody is listening to this and they're at a position where they're stuck at something or they're struggling to get something moving, what's one kind of practical piece of advice that they could do today or within this week that would kind of get that moving for them?
Start working out, man. It's really amazing what physical fitness can do. Because physical fitness, first of all, boxing changed my whole mentality about everything. I used to have a fixed mindset. I have a growth mindset now. And that's one of the reasons why I was able. I failed math in high school and went on to get a, you know, a math minor and a physics major, right? And the reason is physical training is the first, and or physical training is the easiest way to see what happens. When you put effort in somewhere, you can see a real change in the world that the rest of the world can see. And that changes your mind about things. It forces you to take on habits that you would not have otherwise had that have a bunch of positive benefits, positive prayerful benefits that you are not expecting to reap. But what do they say? Positive externalities. There's a lot of them from working out. So that's what I would say. If you're stuck, start working out. And then it's funny what's going to happen. And even if you take, look, even if you're working three jobs and you can't find any time, you'll find the time. And in finding the time, you'll realize what's possible when you put your mind somewhere else. And perhaps you can get into a position where you only have two jobs and then one and then, you know, whatever you got to do. But, yeah, physical. I think physical training is the life hack.
I love that. I love that. It's So what's next for Ed? For Ed Lattimore, what do you have a vision, a mission? What's happening now from here going forward for you?
I can tell you what I'm trying to do in the next probably 18 months. That's pretty much it. Next 18 months, I hope to get my chest rating over 2,000 consistently. I'd like to have another book published. This one, the one on my lessons from the ghetto and kind of where that took me. Probably working on my first kid, if not that kid being here, knowledge of a few more languages from living in Europe and getting over there and just really growing my mission and sight. I'll probably fight again. I mean, the cool thing is like my mission is to get myself better and to experience things and really to show people what's possible because I did not come from a position of privilege. I did not have any advantages whatsoever, except maybe naturally higher than average intelligence. But like, I just want to show people what they can do, and I want to live my life. And doing that, I get to do both. I tell people all the time, I am very lucky. I get to make a living being myself, but who I am took a lot of possibilities of me not being here.
I want to take this opportunity before we wrap up to commend you for what you've done because it's I've been paying attention to you. It's not often that somebody comes along with a consistent, authentic and honest message. I think there's a lot of commodified authenticity out there. And I think that the people who speak their truth, I think that shines true. And I think that does with you and with a number of other people that I pay attention to. So I want to commend you for that. And I wish you best of luck on your travels and your new life in this side of the world. And who knows, we may see each other face to face at some time.
Oh, yeah,
and
we'll be in the same time zone.
We sure will. And thanks so much, Ed. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
Hello, Shane here. Before I wrap up, very, very quick message. Thank you so much, firstly, thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. You are the grade A listener and I salute you for that. Secondly, if anything in here resonated with you, struck a chord with you in any way, it'd be fantastic if you could share this with anybody, wherever you share stuff, whether that's on Twitter, like Ed, whether it's on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, at the bus stop, wherever it is that you're talking to people. If there's something in here that you felt other people need to hear, it'd be great if you could share that on. If it's your first time here, you'll find all the archive of all the previous episodes on my website at shanebreslin.com or by navigating through the archive of your podcast player, whether that's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher. This podcast should be in all those places wherever you listen to podcasts. So that's all for me. I'll be back with another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast very soon. I really hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did. From me, Shane, signing off. Thank you. Bye-bye.